He's known as the world's greatest detective, immortalized in countless stories, movies, TV shows, and even comic books. The inspiration for much of today's detectives, with a personality that grates like cheese and a mind as quick as the trap that cheese is baited with. He's instantly recognizable and recognizably brilliant. Well, by now you should have deduced that I'm talking about the man in the Deerstalker hat, the greatest consulting detective of all time, the one and only Sherlock Holmes. A cultural icon made famous by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. With his chronicling partner, Dr. John Watson, Sherlock Holmes has become the name most closely associated with the detective genre and very much a part of our everyday lexicon. Currently seen on both the big and small screens, Sherlock Holmes has long been a character that engages the imagination and inspires debate and investigation. And at a time when this detective seems as popular as ever and doesn't seem to be fading away anytime soon, we thought we'd like to find out a little bit more. With me this morning to lead us in a bit of deductive investigation on Sherlock Holmes is Nick Utekin. He joined the Sherlock Holmes Society of London at the age of 14. And is now an honorary member. He edited the Sherlock Holmes Journal from 1976 to 2006. And to top it off, he's a distant relative of Basil Rathbone, who some would say, and I would agree, is the best screen Sherlock Holmes of all time. Nick, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Rod.
Why is it that after all these years, Sherlock Holmes is still so popular and is still the byword for a detective? Why? What? I mean, you must have thought about this a lot over the years. Why do you think it's the case?
I think it goes back, Rod, to the brilliance of Arthur Conan Doyle, who created the character. I mean, he wrote the first story, A Study in Scarlet, in 1886. Didn't get it published until Beaton's Christmas Annual the following year, 1887. And he constructed the sort of detective that hadn't really been around before. And even more than that, he created the concept of the foil, the Dr. Watson figure. And that, which has been replicated so many times since then, is at the heart, I think, of the success of Sherlock Holmes. The relationship between the two, the fact that Watson is the sort of the ordinary man in the street, he's you and me, whereas he reflects the light from Sherlock Holmes's brilliance onto his readers. And you can take that step by step through the books, through the short stories, the long stories, and then eventually the good movies, the good television, the good pastiches, the follow-up stories by other people and all that.
It was a brilliant idea by Conan Doyle that rather than have that one detective who goes around solving the crime or whatever it is that he does, he actually has someone, Dr. Watson, to explain it to. The author is not explaining it to the reader. He's actually explaining it to another character who is also very helpful in solving the mysteries.
Oh, absolutely. And also another clever thing that Conan Doyle did is that not all the stories, not all the mysteries have a big murder in them or a huge Hound of the Baskervilles or a snake slithering down the bell pull in the bedroom. Quite a number of the stories don't really have any sort of real crime. And that makes it all the more interesting for Holmes. He doesn't need the huge panache of a monster crime. He looks into things for his own interest. And that, again, is where the writing and the characterization and the relationship between the Holmes and Watson figures transcends the story. I don't often, even after all these years of being involved in Sherlock Holmes, I don't sort of turn the page. Okay, I know the stories very well, but I don't turn the pages saying, gosh, I wonder what's going to happen. What's going to happen? And Conan Doyle, you know, was very clever about that. He created the character, especially when it went into the short story form in 1891, where a commuter could get on a train, and we can maybe talk about further things like the 1870 Education Act, which brought education to a much wider population, could sit on a train and read an 8,000-word or so Sherlock Holmes story and feel satisfied, yes, of course, he's gripped, one hopes, by the writing and by the concepts, but not necessarily, it was Dr. Grimesby Roylott what did it in the speckled band.
Oh, you've given it away.
Oh. Is there someone out there in Australia who hasn't read that?
I'm sure they have. But because he's always been around, we forget that Conan Doyle, he didn't exactly invent the detective, but he certainly popularised it. He was right there at the start of the whole detective genre. There were a couple of books around, The Mystery of a Hansom Cab and the Wilkie Collins novels, but really, Sherlock Holmes has been there for the entire history of the detective genre.
Absolutely, and his stories have never been out of print since 1887 and kept alive in various ways that we'll go on to talk about. He was very lucky. The first two stories he wrote, A Study in Scarlet, which went down quite well, and he was paid £25 for it, and that was he never got any more for that story at all. They paid him just a one-off, a buyout, as we would say these days. And then he just let that character rest because it had gone down fairly well, but nothing spectacular. It just appeared in a Christmas annual, the sort of thing that appeared all over the place. And then there was a famous dinner at the Langham Hotel in central London when in 1890, so 3 years later, an American editor or publisher called Stoddart came over, and he wanted to find two up-and-coming British authors to contribute to something that he published called Lippincott's Magazine. And over that dinner, he asked Arthur Conan Doyle to write something, and that turned into the second Sherlock Holmes story, a long one called The Sign of Four. And there was another young man who was beginning to make a name for himself, and he was called Oscar Wilde. And at that dinner, which must have been one hell of a dinner, Oscar Wilde eventually turned out the picture of Dorian Gray.
Wow.
So if it hadn't been for that 1890 dinner, it's possible that Sherlock would have founded. And then crucially, a year later, in 1891, the concept of the short story came to him, that Conan Doyle can just do it in one burst, mm-hmm. 7,000 to 8,000 words, could be read at one go, and didn't need to be carried over from issue to issue, and therefore his customers, his readers, could be sated in one go,
sure.
and then still, of course, want to buy the next issue.
That first story, Study in Scarlet, how much of the template of Holmes as we know him at the end of the stories, and even today, was set in that first one?
I think almost immediately. I mean, when Watson, who has just been invalided out of the Second Afghan War and comes to London, that great cesspit, he refers to it, mm-hmm. and is introduced to Sherlock Holmes because basically he, Watson, can't afford to rent a place by himself, so he needs to share. And straight away, as soon as Holmes sees him, he says, "You have been in Afghanistan, I perceive." So we've got the relationship straight away. He puts Watson slightly on the back foot. He's already showing that he can just look at a person and immediately deduce X, Y, and Z from him or her. And so the scene is straight away set. And Watson makes it absolutely clear. Sorry, I'm using the word Watson, meaning Conan Doyle, but this is the game
yes.
we're playing. Watson makes it absolutely clear that here is a sort of a slightly interesting man who is certainly not pursuing sort of normal run-of-the-mill job. When he first meets him, he's saying that he has discovered an entirely new form for recognizing blood off a dead body. He's going to call it the Sherlock Holmes blood test or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then Watson, sort of, they do set up rooms in 221B Baker Street, and he's surprised by the motley crew of people who come and visit Holmes, because, of course, at that stage, Watson is excluded. He's not quite been brought in yet. And so Holmes will suddenly disappear and do what he has to do. And the reader is intrigued more and more through the eyes of Watson as to this slightly mysterious, slightly distant character. Then, of course, when Holmes finally says, "Watson, would you like to join me on dashing out to try and find out who's murdered Enoch Drebber?" He's reeled in properly, and the rest literally is history.
It's unbelievable, then, that if that dinner party hadn't come about, the story would have ended there and there would have been no more Sherlock Holmes. How dedicated to Holmes was Conan Doyle? Because it really became a bit of a problem for him later on. He tried to kill off Holmes. What was he doing at the time that he decided, "Well, I'm going to write this story"?
Well, we're jumping ahead a bit. In 1890, he was already starting to publish one or two of these slightly weightier and heavier things, like The Mystery of Cloomber. Hmm. And various short stories, nothing to do with Sherlock Holmes, had been accepted by magazines like Blackwood's magazines, and nothing much was happening to him on that front. Because, of course, he did have a day job. He was an ophthalmologist, as we say. He was an eye doctor. And he set up in London. That is what he'd been a general practitioner down in Southsea, in Portsmouth, and that's where he wrote Sherlock Holmes, A Study in Scarlet. Then he moved up with all sorts of plans that he was going to, you know, be the London eye doctor. Set up premises just, as it happened, sort of not very far from Baker Street, and absolutely no one visited him. And he sat in his doctor's surgery, and turned his mind to that character. Let's have a think. What can I do? What might work? He turned to Sherlock, and we have the dinner party, and then we have the short stories. He was very, very lucky that two things happened at around this time. There had been the 1870 Education Act, which meant that for the first time in the UK, people were able to get a perfectly reasonable education without being rich. They didn't have to pay to go to school or college. And that inevitably led to more and more people knowing how to read. And then at the same time, a lot of magazines were set up to provide this new and burgeoning audience for something to read. And so there was the Pall Mall magazine and the Strand magazine, paramountly the Strand magazine, which promised to put a picture on every page. It cost sixpence, and it would have new literary stories. It would have parliamentary reports. It would have a page of curiosities. Can you guess what this photograph is of? It would have translations of stories by people like Guy de Maupassant, which had appeared in French publications. And Conan Doyle spotted this. The editor of the Strand magazine saw that he had an unbelievable success on his hands. And despite what happened later on, Conan Doyle gave up his failing medical practice and turned to 100% writing.
On ABC Local Radio, you're with Rod Quinn. My guest is Nick Utekin, and he's the former editor of the Sherlock Holmes Journal, honorary member of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, former chief producer at BBC Radio 4, journalist and a distant relative of the greatest Sherlock Holmes of them all, Basil Rathbone. One of the things about Holmes is that he's a genius. He's brilliant. He can detect, as you mentioned, with Watson. He knew immediately that Watson had recently come back from Afghanistan, I think because what of the shoes he's wearing or the dust on his shoes or something, wasn't it?
That's right, and the colour of his face and the military bearing. Yeah. All sorts of things come together in one immediate deduction.
But it wasn't outrageous or unbelievable. It was all deduction. He knew a hell of a lot. Was Holmes, in fact, a lot smarter than Conan Doyle?
Well, that's a very interesting way of putting it. Let's say I'm going to turn it around the other way, because, of course, Conan Doyle was able to install this smartness, as you put it, on Sherlock Holmes, because he, Conan Doyle, had in his student days at Edinburgh University worked with the absolute template of what was to become the great detective, and that was his teacher at Edinburgh University, Dr. Joseph Bell.
Yeah.
And Dr. Joseph Bell, to whom Conan Doyle was an assistant, used to have his classes, his medical classes, just is sitting in wonderment. And he would genuinely have patients come in, and he would turn to his class and say, "Well, now look, can you tell me what's wrong with this person just by looking at him?" And then he would look at him and not touch him or not take a pulse or not take a temperature or anything like that and say, "Well, I think you've got that. I also noticed that you probably live in that part of Edinburgh because the dust and the mud on your shoes is only from that part of Edinburgh and therefore you've walked from there, blah, 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 blah." And Conan Doyle rooted all this away in the back of his mind and turned it to his advantage. Now, let us turn it to your question. He created someone who, by definition, is above us all, probably, in intellect, and the power of immediate assessment and the power of saying, "Well, look, if that scrawled letter on that piece of paper is written in that form, then the person is left-handed, and if I smell the paper, it was almost certainly from a very upmarket London hotel, etc., etc. And he just sort of took on a little bit further what Joseph Bell had taught him.
Right.
And always had correct answers.
For yes.
and just let Watson and his readers go, wow.
But he also had an incredible knowledge of timetables, train timetables. Well, he knew everything about when newspapers were published, when trains ran, who was living where, when.
But he also makes a huge number of mistakes.
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's a story called Silver Blaze, which involves racehorses, and it's a great story, and I won't give away the ending of that.
Thank you.
But he later said in a piece of correspondence, what I wrote about the study of racehorses and what goes on race courses, I would be warned off the turf forever. And this, in a sense, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, leads directly to this game of Sherlock Holmes that we play, this pseudo-scholarship that
yes.
people like me and many others enjoy immensely. You can play around with all the errors and the hints that Conan Doyle strews around his stories, undeliberately, and then we just sort of take it too damn seriously occasionally.
I don't think so. We're drawn in to the detective stories, but how good a writer is Conan Doyle, especially as we learn about the London of the time or the UK at the time? How good a writer is Conan Doyle?
I think he's a very good and very descriptive writer, and of course he was writing of what was outside his front window. He also kept in touch with changes. I mean, we all think of hansom cabs and the four-wheeled carriages called growlers, and that was the precursor of taxi cabs and all that sort of thing. That was the way that people paid to get around London. He was aware of course, the beginning of the underground subway system. When he travels out into the country, Watson stroke Doyle is very, very descriptive, quite often setting the scene for something a little bit more horrific, of course. So you've got in the invention of the Boscombe Valley mystery, you've got sort of bucolic countryside and a little pool and some willows around it, and well, there's been a dead body found there. Of course, the prime example of this is The Hound of the Baskervilles,
yep.
which I suppose, in the end, everyone would say is the best known, their favourite, whatever, which by definition is full of extremely good writing and descriptive writing. Again, one or two inaccuracies come in, and it doesn't matter that he invents the name of one or two things like the Great Grimpen Mire. It doesn't exist, but by goodness me, it sounds good and
does.
Well off the page. And he also was a very good technician in his writing, and I stay with The Hound of the Baskervilles, which was serialized in the Strand magazine over about 9, 10 issues. And so obviously people, you know, he really wanted people to keep on buying it, and it's classic precipice stuff. The last paragraph of chapter 2 and therefore issue 2 of the Hound of the Baskervilles in the Strand magazine was when the body of Sir Charles Baskerville has been found dead, and the person telling Holmes this story, Dr. James Mortimer, says that he went up and stood by the body, and then Mr. Holmes, there were various prints around the dead body. Oh, said Holmes, a man or a woman's? Mr. Holmes, they were the prints of a gigantic hound.
Beautifully
and you can
done.
Just hear every
yes.
single piece of hair rising on the head of people reading that, and my goodness me, they were going to go and buy the next issue.
In a way, Conan Doyle was captured by his creation. That he tried to kill him off, then had to bring him back. How much of a millstone round Conan Doyle's neck was Sherlock Holmes?
I think Conan Doyle never realised how big a success and how instant a success it was going to be. He initially signed up with Greenough Smith, the editor of the Strand magazine, to write 6, and then that became 12 stories. I can't remember exactly what the fee was at the time, but I mean, you know, fairly good. He wrote very quickly as well, so it didn't take him too much time, and he was able to think of plots quite easily. And then he sort of wavered, and then, of course, they came straight back and said, we want another 12. And he apparently, well, he wrote in his diary or said to somebody, well, I increased my price, hoping that that would put them off. Well, no, not at all. It didn't put them off in the least. What he, Conan Doyle, basically wanted to do was to be remembered for his rather ponderous historical fiction set in medieval times, books like The White Company and Sir Nigel, which are great romances with men with swords and suits of armour. And didn't Conan Doyle like you to know that he had researched absolutely everything about those suits of armour? So it just gets in the way of the slightly plodding plot anyway, that whenever a bloke gets up on a horse to lead a charge or something, you have to describe every armlet and every leg protector that he would have worn. And that is what he wanted to be remembered for, and he famously wrote to his mother, Conan Doyle did, Sherlock Holmes takes my mind from better things. Well, that was his impression that they were better things, but they certainly weren't for the public. But he did, yeah. When he and Professor Moriarty meet at the Reichenbach Falls in The Final Problem, he leaves the door open half an inch. You don't actually see Holmes's body. Oh, I mustn't give something away.
Well, I think if they've seen the latest film, they should be familiar with it.
You don't actually see Holmes's body bouncing off the boulder at the bottom. But as far as he was concerned, he was certainly killing Sherlock Holmes off.
He wanted to.
And then there are all these stories about letters coming in from members of the public beginning, "You brute," and apocryphal stories about young businessmen in the City of London wearing black armbands. It was a financial disaster for the Strand magazine.
I mean, you know,
their sales slumped inevitably. And then when he brought back Holmes, he brings him back in The Hound of the Baskervilles, but luckily for him, he sets it in a chronological time before,
of course,
Holmes is alleged to have gone over the Reichenbach Falls. And then slowly but surely, and the drip, 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 it has to be said, of money, worked for him. And by the end, by the 1920s, Conan Doyle was being paid by his American publishers a dollar a word.
Wow.
Now, that's an American dollar per word for a Sherlock Holmes story. And I don't know what the maths would be, but, I mean, that is extremely huge payment.
So, therefore, when he was writing for money rather than love, are those later Sherlock Holmes stories as good as the earlier ones?
Oh, I think there's absolutely no doubt that many of them weren't. Some of them were. There is an absolute cracker, which is my personal favourite, and I would recommend anyone who's never read a Sherlock Holmes story to pick this one up. It's called The Adventure of the Bruce Partington Plans, and it's got absolutely everything in it from, well, no, I won't give things away. But that was a later one. But there are one or two stories that really he's just redoing the same plot as he had done 25 years earlier with another and better story.
Okay.
And to be perfectly honest, as well as the size of money he was getting, he was also, by that stage, and this is a problem that engages people who love Conan Doyle's work, he had become possessed by spiritualism and therefore was pouring almost all his money and all the income that he was getting into a spiritualist bookshop and the crusade for spiritualism that he took to the grave.
And trying to find fairies at the bottom of the garden.
Well, this was one of the saddest things, the Cottingley Fairies. Anyone who looks at those photographs taken by the two girls aged whatever they were, 11 and 12 or 12 and 13, you can look at those photographs and it doesn't take an idiot, Rod, to see that there is absolutely no way that they are anything other than cut out bits of paper, rather well drawn, and placed in front of a lens. But the Cottingley Fairies went down in history. He wrote an article about them and then a short a book about them. And it was only many, many years later, in I think almost the late 1960s, when one of the girls, now by then a very old lady, actually said, well, we faked it.
We made it up.
Surprise, surprise. But it was very unfortunate, very gullible. And he was such a prominent member of society and such a well-known author that a lot of people just sort of thought, what on earth is Conan Doyle on about? Why doesn't he just do what he's best at? And we mustn't forget that as well as Sherlock Holmes, he created the character of Professor Challenger, So we wouldn't have had The Lost World, which is the great Professor Challenger book, and that means you wouldn't have had the movie Jurassic Park 20 years ago. He also created Brigadier Gerard, who was a dashing French Napoleonic officer, almost a comic character, who lived and loved and lusted and lashed across Europe throughout the Napoleonic era. Conan Doyle was a master of different forms of fiction, but of course it is Sherlock Holmes for which he will forever be remembered.
This morning we're going to find out a little bit more about how Sherlock Holmes has been depicted away from the page. And it all began on the stage, but I'll let Nick take up the story.
Crucially, in 1899, and it was onto the stage, there was a very well-known American actor called William Gillette, who had met Conan Doyle once or twice. And it wasn't a sort of a very difficult piece of brain work to work out that if Sherlock Holmes could be translated to the stage and written up well, it could work and be a financial success. And he famously wrote to Conan Doyle and he said, "May I marry Holmes?" And now this is quite a difficult area we're getting into. Mm-hmm. And Conan Doyle straight away, and this shows what he felt of the character at that stage, he said, "You may marry him or murder him or do what you like with him." Now that gave William Gillette carte blanche, and he does have Holmes fall in love. And this play absolutely stormed on both sides of the Atlantic. And he performed it from 1899 until his farewell tour in 1937.
Well, nearly 40 years.
Precisely so, and brought it, of course, to a huge audience. Now, by then, the filmmakers were getting interested. There's an extraordinary 16 seconds of film from something like 1906, called Sherlock Holmes Baffled, and that was the first appearance on film. And then in this country, a silent film actor called Eileen Norwood was signed up by a film production company, and he just cranked them out. Because in those days, you know, you could make a short film for 15 minutes or 18 yeah. minutes or so. And he cranked out over 20 of them. And of course, at this stage, with the growth of cinema, you are now expanding hugely those people who have heard of the concept of Sherlock Holmes. And that was in the 20s. Then he was picked up by no less people than John Barrymore, for example, in the 1930s. Then we process. There's always a new Sherlock Holmes, mm-hmm. it seems, each decade. And along comes the quintessential Basil yeah. Rathbone. And it just shows the success of the character, and yet again, if you play him carefully and don't make him too clever, too ludicrous, don't frighten the audience away, there will always be a success on celluloid.
What I find interesting then is that if people say, "Oh, that's not how Sherlock Holmes would behave," or "I don't like what they've done with that Sherlock Holmes with TV or movies," you've got to go all the way back, as you've said, from what Conan Doyle was saying about that first stage production. Marry him, murder him, do with him what you will. Really, yeah. anyone who takes up that Holmes character can basically play Holmes any way they want.
They can, and sadly, in some cases...
They have. Well, let's go then to, I think, the best one. As you mentioned, Basil Rathbone, which was a really interesting series of about, what, a dozen films in the 30s and 40s with the great Nigel Bruce as Dr. Watson. Doing Dr. Watson no favours. He was kind of a bumbling buffoon, wasn't he? And Watson was never like that.
No, absolutely not. I think the character of Watson is almost as deserving of interest as Sherlock Holmes, as I've tried to imply every now and then.
Yes.
You have to remember that in the writing, the way that Conan Doyle portrayed him, first of all, Watson was a military man. He'd served his country. He was a trained doctor. He was only at most 2 years older than Sherlock Holmes, if you work the chronology out. He had an experience of women that crosses three continents. Mm-hmm. All these things utterly different from Sherlock Holmes. The thing about Nigel Bruce is that he had already established himself as one of these sort of leading members of the English community in Hollywood.
Yeah. The Hollywood Cricket Club and all that.
The Hollywood Cricket Club and all that, and David Niven was there, yes. and Basil Rathbone was there, and C. Aubrey Smith was the captain. And there was a certain sort of character that Nigel Bruce was known to play, and he effectively was told to play Watson like this. and in somebody's wonderful phrase, the Bubus Britannicus, he was described as. It was a little bit of a disappointment, but the audiences absolutely lapped it up, and yet again it sort of drew the difference between the cool, laconic, driven Sherlock Holmes, as Basil Rathbone did him, up against the sort of, well, yes, this buffoonish Watson. And then, of course, the first two stories, The Hound of the Baskervilles and The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, are two very good proper films. Yeah. The remaining 12, as many will know, because they're on show on television somewhere every single second of of every 24 hours somewhere in the world, more than half of them were straight anti-Nazi propaganda.
Yes, you can buy them in a box set here. We sell them at the ABC shop. They are fantastic, very, very enjoyable films. But as you say, there was a kind of a mix between those that were set at the time of Sherlock Holmes, and then they parachuted Sherlock Holmes into the time that the films were being made, and that was in the lead-up to the war or during World War II, Sherlock Holmes in Washington.
I mean, you've got Sherlock Holmes in Washington, you know, trying to outdo the Nazis. You have Sherlock Holmes quoting Winston Churchill as the payoff line in one of the films. They were very short films as well, those later ones, the Universal films. They were only a touch over an hour long. Yeah. They could be made in just a few days. And they were, you know, just like part of the war effort.
Exactly. But they're still very enjoyable films.
Of course, and not for a second. And I wouldn't dare be rude about them because I'm related to Basil Rathbone. my middle name is Rathbone. My grandfather and he were third cousins. So I've dropped down to a couple of generations from that. But and sadly, in 1967, just a year after I joined the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, I found an address for Basil Rathbone in New York. And I wrote to him and sort of said, you know, hey, I'm your whatever cousin, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I had dreams of scripts and pipes and deerstalkers coming over the Atlantic in my direction. And Basil Rathbone died 3 days later.
No.
This was truly bad luck, well, certainly for him, and bad luck for me, so I'm sure he never even saw that letter.
They were well-known, as I say, in the 30s and 40s. Was there a kind of a dip after that, that people felt that you couldn't match Rathbone and Bruce as Holmes and Watson? What was going on in the 50s and 60s when it came to Sherlock Holmes on film or TV?
Peter Cushing appeared in Hound of the Baskervilles on film in 1959.
Right.
But not a lot was happening in the 1950s. And then you suddenly get another explosion of interest in the 60s when an English actor called Douglas Wilmer, who is still alive, is a friend of mine, and is 92.
Wow. And still working.
Well, I'll tell you something about him in just a minute. He was Sherlock Holmes for BBC television in 1964-65. And for people of my age and generation and the people who are running things like the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, etc., he, for us, is Sherlock Holmes. He is well-retired, but has a guest appearance in the third and final episode of Sherlock on television.
Incredible. I love it when they do that. But when you look at the actors who've played Sherlock Holmes, I think Roger Moore played Sherlock Holmes. Nicole Williamson, who died just recently, played Sherlock Holmes.
John Neville.
Who died recently as well, yeah.
We've also had a lovely humorous film called Without a Clue.
Yes.
With Ben Kingsley as Watson and Michael Caine as an invented Sherlock Holmes. And that is great fun. That came out in the early mid-80s.
What do you make of Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law?
I think when people like us sort of first heard that Guy Ritchie was going to be making a Sherlock Holmes film, that was where the initial sort of cause for concern was. The casting of Robert Downey Jr. is extraordinary. I think I have enjoyed both these films because, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sort of old style and been around for a long time, anything that keeps the Sherlock Holmes brand up and in front of younger people, perhaps, who have got so much more to do and so much more stuff bombarding them in all sorts of ways. I can quite understand why Ritchie has updated the character in the way that he has, and it's basically a Guy Ritchie adventure movie with Sherlock Holmes in it.
Exactly right. They use Sherlock Holmes' name. They could have come up with their own detective set in Victorian London or Edwardian London and done that, but they were playing on Holmes's name to get some sort of name recognition, and I don't know, they're certainly not necessarily faithful to the books.
Oh, no.
But I don't like them at all, really. I think they do a disservice to Sherlock Holmes's name.
Well, I think we slightly part company there. I don't think it's as strong as a disservice. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the sheer fact of the extraordinary amounts of money that they've made, the two films so far, shows that it's going to be going on. I believe there's going to be a third one as well. You know, why not? I think the second one, A Game of Shadows, is certainly better than the first. Mm-hmm. It's more sure-footed, and there is a recognisable story, which there wasn't really in the first one. Okay. I think, again, the relationship is quite clever between Jude Law as Watson and Robert Downey Jr. as Holmes. There's a little bit of homoerotic stuff floating around, but nothing that would offend a purist, I don't think. And they, you know, again, you've got at the heart of the films whatever slam bam gunshots going on all around the place. You've got a warm relationship and a humorous relationship between the two, utterly reliant upon each other in their different ways, and that is true to the basic core of what Conan Doyle originally published.
On ABC Local Radio, you're with Rod Quinn. My guest is Nick Utekin, and he's the former editor of the Sherlock Holmes Journal, honorary member of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, former chief producer at BBC Radio 4, journalist and a distant relative of Basil Rathbone. Who is the best screen or TV Holmes and Watson? Were they always in the same TV show, perhaps? Maybe there was a good Holmes in one and a better Watson somewhere else. What do you think?
Well, for your listeners, I'm going to return to Douglas Wilmer and his Watson, who was called Nigel Stock. Now, they only appeared in 13 episodes. The BBC, in their wisdom, naturally wiped most of the transmissions, and only recently have versions of them appeared. I think Nigel Stock, who then went on to be Dr. Watson to Peter Cushing when Cushing took over from Douglas Wilmer on the BBC, was probably the best Watson from my point of view. Although I will put in a late bid for Colin Blakely, who appeared in the Billy Wilder film The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes with Robert Stevens. Now, this has become a cult movie. It was a financial disaster and completely messed around when it was released in 1970. But Billy Wilder is a very, very great director, and there's an awful lot in there. So I'm going to put a vote in for Colin Blakely there as a Watson. As far as Holmes is concerned, I'm probably going to go with Christopher Plummer in a film called Murder by Decree, which is one of the Jack the Ripper-type movies. I think he does a very, very good Sherlock Holmes there indeed.
And it's a very interesting movie. There's a TV show as well at the moment called Sherlock, which is a pretty short show. It's only, three episodes or so, or in this series. Benedict Cumberbatch plays Holmes, and Martin Freeman, who people would know from The Office, plays Watson. What do you make of that?
A lot more people are going to know Martin Freeman very soon because he's also filming The Hobbit.
Yes,
and
indeed.
That is going to be a monster series of films. I am absolutely intrigued, fascinated, and adore it. I was interviewed several times 18 months ago when the first series of three films came out, and people again expected me to be snorting and sort of thinking, oh gosh, no, this is utterly not. It has been updated by Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss absolutely brilliantly. There are many, many happy nods in the direction of the originals, some that could be picked up by the general audience, others are very nicely picked up by those of us who know our Sherlock Holmes fairly well. It is very audacious television as well. There's an awful lot going on the screen, which is quite remarkably well done in comparison with, you know, much of the fairly sort of average television that we certainly have over here, and I don't know what it's like with you in Australia so much. Mm-hmm. After the third and final episode of the current series, everything went completely viral on Facebook and right. Twitter and things, with people trying to work out exactly what had happened. I certainly won't say anything more about it.
Okay.
But it's also in this country been picking up viewing figures of 10 or 11 million, which for these days is quite extraordinary. And Sunday evenings have become Sherlock nights. And there are groups on the internet. There's a group of ladies who've called themselves the Cumber Bitches.
Come on.
So that shows you how things have gone over here.
Has that translated into an increase in number of people who are members of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London? Tell me about that society. It's been going for, 60 years?
Yeah, we just celebrated our Diamond Jubilee last year, 2011. The society was founded in 1951 as a result of the Festival of Britain, which was held in 1951 yep. and was meant to sort of make post-Second World War Britain feel a little bit happier about yeah. itself. And the borough of St. Marylebone wanted to put on, which is where Baker Street is, wanted to put on an exhibition of slum clearance. And people thought, well, this doesn't really sort of go down very well as a celebration. And somebody wrote a letter to the Times newspaper and said, surely the life and times of the most famous resident of St. Marylebone should be highlighted. That immediately turned into an exhibition about Sherlock Holmes. Four people connected with that exhibition sat down and said, why don't we resuscitate the Sherlock Holmes Society of London? They had in the mid-30s. Been a society, but that didn't really survive for more than a couple of years. And unbelievably, 60 years later, here we still are with a membership around the world of, in round figures, about 1,500, which has increased by about 200 or so in the last few months. Such a boom in Sherlock at the moment we're certainly picking up on it quite successfully. We publish a journal twice a year. That's what I edited for 30 years. And, you know, we just play the game. What has to be remembered is the famous quote by the writer Dorothy L. Sayers, who once said back in 1946, I think, the game of Sherlock Holmes must be played as seriously as a county cricket match at Lord's.
Uh-huh.
Now, you as an Aussie will know perfectly well how important cricket is.
Indeed.
across the divide between where I'm sitting and where you're sitting. And basically what she means by that is that we all know that Sherlock Holmes is a fictitious character, that he appears in 56 short stories and 4 long stories. Conan Doyle makes all those mistakes, so let's just play the game as if he was real. Mm. So I write things like, which university did Holmes go to? Was it Oxford or Cambridge? And how many wives did Dr. Watson have? And that sort of game.
We know that Conan Doyle didn't write Elementary, My Dear Watson. Did he say the game's afoot, Watson? Did Sherlock Holmes say that? Because I think it turns up in the movies.
Yeah, no, he certainly doesn't say Elementary, My Dear Watson. He says My Dear Watson constantly, and he says Elementary every now and then. But I think it was Basil Rathbone who actually first put the two together, the scripts of one of his films there. Come Watson, the game's afoot is the start, I believe, of the Abbey Grange.
Okay. What about memorabilia of Sherlock Holmes? What remains of Conan Doyle? Or what remains of Sherlock Holmes from that time? I mean, does the society have a collection? Tell me about what you might have as regards memorabilia.
Well, the society as such doesn't have a collection because we have no sort of rooms, or there's no sort of central place where you could put it. There is a Sherlock Holmes library. It's a collection of books and journals and magazines, and that is held at the Westminster City Libraries, which is indeed where two of the founding members of the society worked when they were setting up that exhibition in 51. There's also a pub in London called the Sherlock Holmes just off Trafalgar Square, and that has residual stuff from that 1951 exhibition. But there is an awful lot around from the bibliographical point of view. I mean, I regret to say that you now have to have quite a deep pocket to be able to afford some of the things. But I was lucky enough that I started collecting in the late 60s when you could pick up first editions for, not quite for a song, but, you know, for example, my first edition of The Hound of the Baskervilles cost me £20, and I probably wouldn't sell it for less than 3,000.
Wow, that's incredible, isn't it?
But, you know, I was just very, very lucky. And then there are all the pseudo-scholarship books, because we haven't mentioned the United States in all this, because in the United States there's been a group of Sherlock Holmes aficionados called the Baker Street Irregulars, and that was effectively founded in the mid-1930s mm-hmm. and has been running all the way through, and they have a journal. And they have at any given time in the United States about 50 or 60 smaller societies spread around various states. Some of them may be just a dining club with 12 members, but others, you know, with a couple of hundred or whatever. And they all publish some things as well. So it is a quite extraordinary global... I mean, there was a Sherlock Holmes Society of Australia. I was in correspondence for many years with a guy sadly now dead called Alan Olding. I think there is a society in Victoria now.
Okay.
And Japan, and India, and France, and Switzerland, and Germany, and I could go on.
What about London today? I mean, can you go on a walking tour of Sherlock Holmes? Is there much that remains that Conan Doyle wrote about? I mean, 221B Baker Street, I know, exists, but last time I saw it, it was like a building society or something.
This, you're getting into very deep waters, my dear.
Right.
If I may say so. One of the great games we play is identifying which was originally 221B Baker Street,
uh-huh.
and it certainly had nothing whatsoever to do with the present number 221 in Baker Street, which uh-huh. is in those days called Upper Baker Street, and the Adi National Building Society, as was, used to occupy that. There is a building next door to that, which for legal reasons I won't be too rude about, that sets itself up as the Sherlock Holmes Museum.
Indeed.
And I would suggest that maybe some of your listeners visiting London might prefer to go to the Sherlock Holmes pub off Trafalgar Square. There's a statue of Sherlock Holmes outside Baker Street Underground Station, which is just on the Marylebone Road, off which Baker Street runs. But a lot of London, despite what has been happening further east, like Canary Wharf and the City of London, you can still go to Baker Street and you can still see some house frontages that are basically unchanged. There's a Sherlock Holmes Hotel in Baker Street, which I've never stayed in for obvious reasons, but there's a lot going on. And Baker Street Tube Station, the walls are all painted with sort of deerstalkers and pipes.
Right.
And there are certainly walks professionally, I mean, you have to pay for them, walks connected with Sherlock Holmes's London.
What about Australia? Is there a Sherlock Holmes connection beyond the fact that you would have members here or that there would have been a Sherlock Holmes Society? What about in the original stories? Was there any mention of Australia?
Well, certainly Dr. Watson mentions that he remembered, so we try and work out that when he was a child, almost certainly he did travel to Australia. That's mentioned in one of the very early stories. But the only one that has a true Australian background is the Boscombe Valley Mystery, which revolves around the gold diggings at Ballarat. But many years later, two people involved at the gold diggings are come together in a curious fashion in the south of England, and one of them dies.
Okay. Sherlock Holmes has been part of your life since, what, you were a teenager? Really?
A young teenager. I joined the society in 1966. When I was eight, my mother gave me The Hound of the Baskervilles to read for Christmas, and that was just a bit too early.
Right.
And then my great-aunt, about when I was 12, gave me an omnibus volume of the short stories, and that's about the right age to catch the Sherlock Holmes disease. And critically, then I got out of the library in 1962 a biography of Sherlock Holmes, and at the back there was an address for the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. I had no idea that such a thing existed. And so, yes, I joined up, and on and on and on and on, on it's gone.
Do you wish that there had been more stories? Are there enough?
Oh, my goodness, what a very interesting question. Well, I think by definition, when the later stories are, as I've described them, some not nearly as good as they were, I think probably Conan Doyle had reached a finite number. Right. He was quite clever. One point I haven't mentioned hitherto is in updating. I mean, we tend to think of Sherlock Holmes as exclusively Victorian and pea soup of fogs, yeah, and hansom cabs and cobblestones. But then there are telephones and there are cars. The last Sherlock Holmes story was published in 1927, wow, 40 years after the first one was published. So, you know, inevitably Conan Doyle, writing for a new audience all the time, was updating and keeping things going, keeping things moving. But I have a feeling that if he'd written any more, that this explosion of scholarship would just be completely never-ending. We found enough over the last 60 years to write about. Yeah. I think the mind would go into a tailspin.
Can you imagine what your life would have been like without Sherlock Holmes?
I'd be a little bit richer than I am, which isn't saying very much. My wife would say that she would have more room for her books on the shelves than I have. Look, I don't know, Rod, if you've got a hobby. Maybe you collect stamps, maybe you go fishing, maybe you, I don't know. This happens to be something that I latched onto, and I enjoy writing and I enjoy researching. I don't enjoy dressing up, incidentally. The Sherlock Holmes Society has a core of members. In fact, there's going to be an expedition to Switzerland, to the Reichenbach Falls, later this year. But they all dress up in Victorian costume. And although the pressure is intense on me as an honorary member to go, A, my wife has said no, and B, I don't want to dress up either. But that's another matter.
Nick Yucatan, our Sherlock Holmes expert.